Everyone, to a fabulous new Whisper in the Wings from Stage Whisper. We are joined by another incredible artist with a fabulous show. Joining us today, we have the playwright Robert Leibowitz, who's stopping by to talk about None of the Above Theater Company's presentation of 45 Scenes of Bad Sickness. It's playing May 25th through June 2nd, Thursdays through Sundays, at the Little Church, and you can get your tickets and more information by visiting ticketstripe.com. This is a fascinating story. It really is, and I can't wait to share this with you as well as more detail and insight from our guests. So let's go ahead and welcome on our guest, Robert. Welcome to Whisper in the Wings from Stage Whisper.
Thank you, Andrew, and happy to be here, and thank you for having me.
I'm so happy you're here. I can't wait to dive into this piece. So let's just kick things off by having you tell us a little bit about what 45 Scenes of Bad Sickness is about.
The play, you know, as happens often in life, first, as a playwright, you learn many things. And one of them is, first you live it, and then you write it. So when, chronologically, when the play occurs, was the summer of 2022, let's say it's 2 years ago, and a theater company I was involved in had just produced a dismal show that nobody saw, and I was feeling horrible, and I was profoundly overweight, and, you know, eating my weight to satisfaction. And we know, you know, anybody who's been an overeater in their lives know that that will never have a happy ending. And so this didn't. And about a week after the show ended, which is in, let's say, July of 2022, COVID attacked me. And because I had high blood pressure, was profoundly overweight, and a myriad of other health reasons, they rushed me to the hospital, into ICU, where I spent 17 days. And then, long story short, I had to spend about 12 weeks, 3 months in three different hospitals while they cured me, which they did, and another 3 months to learn how to walk again. So 6 months in the hospital system in New York City. When COVID attacked me, I lost my ability to walk for about 37 days. And so when you can't walk and you're laying in a hospital bed and you have to go to the bathroom by using a pen or a bottle, it changes your perspective of things. And it certainly did mine. And the encounters that I had with the various hospital personnel, I had the presence of mind to always be like the artist, be the playwright, even though I'm fighting for my life. And I remember thinking or writing or feeling, oh, wow, what the nurse just said to me was very interesting, or what the doctor said was very compelling, or there's some drama here, and maybe one day we might make a decent play. So once I regained my health, which was, let's say, January of 23, and started to walk again, although with a cane, and now I'm thankfully not walking, I'm walking kind of okay now, I said, you know what, there's a play here. And let me cover ground where there are no footprints in the snow. Let my audience, or would-be potential audience, experience and feel what it's like to be in the ICU unit of a hospital and to go through the healthcare system. And I had coverage, which covered me the whole 6 months, but also ran into one obstacle after another. There's an old saying, Andrew, that goes like this: God never made a mountain with a smooth side. And I believe that with the whole of my heart. And this journey that I went through is testament to that saying. Nothing was ever easy. And I'm fortunate to come out on the other side of it. And I feel, at least I think that I am, a better human and a better man for surviving and prevailing my journey.
Wow. Wow, what an incredible story. What an incredible journey. That's amazing. I'm so glad you've come out on the other end better. That's the important part, because this could have been a completely different story, but I'm happy.
Oh, for sure. We might have been having a different conversation, for sure. Yeah. That's for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So I would love to know what inspired you to pen this, to bring this story to the stage.
I've always been attracted, since I'm a young boy, to the spoken word. That starts with my dad, who was a very colorful, charismatic person. And the stuff that would come out of his mouth, like somebody wrote a book 5-10 years ago called Shit That My Dad Says. And I saw this book on a bookshelf and I said, God damn it, that writer beat me to it because I could have written a book with the shit that my dad said, which I always found to be really insightful and compelling and funny and sarcastic and all of that. So I've always been drawn to the spoken word. And this play is my 23rd, and 18 of the 23 have been produced in New York because, like I said, always been drawn to the spoken word and how people view life through the prism of their own experience and how they shape their words in depicting and expressing that vision. It's always fascinated to me. So somebody like David Mamet, who's probably my favorite playwright, his characters are so vibrant and they're so colorful, and the stuff that comes out of their mouth is just breathtakingly beautiful. It's like music to me. And when I was in the hospital, even though fighting for my life, I remember hearing the doctors and the sordid nurses and people that visited me, obviously, and the things that came out of their mouth say, wow, this, you know, this belongs on a stage. If I survive this, I think I'm going to put this on a stage because people need to be exposed to this, because these are very interesting, compelling characters and also would serve as an educational and an entertaining way, which is what theater is about anyway. And let me bring these characters to life to an audience. So to tweak it a little bit further, it's a one-man show where I'm playing. I'm not even acting. I'm like a storyteller. The French have a word for it. They call it a raconteur. And so I'm just telling one story after another. However, I'm joined by six very capable actors and actresses who are playing the 75 other roles of the play. So they're each doing like 8, 10, 12 different roles to demonstrate their acting chops and also to try to depict the hospital experience in a theatrical, imaginative way as best as possible. And it all comes back to the spoken word. I teach playwriting like informally, and I'm a dramaturg for like several young playwrights. And what I try to teach them and impress upon them is the following. Playwriting is the art of the spoken word, period. It is nothing more. It is nothing less. You need to be in the stream of human consciousness and the stream of human experience and find and be and pluck and find people who when they speak, music comes out of their mouth. They're not just like the regular Joe that's riding the train or hanging out in the Starbucks or all that other crap. They have a unique vision to life and they express it in a unique way. And so when we look at theater history, the 2300 or 2400 years of it, we are drawn to people like Hamlet or Tom in Glass Menagerie or Stanley in Streetcar or Bernie Litko in Sexual Perversity in Chicago by Mamet or any one of Eugene O'Neill's characters or Lanford Wilson or a thousand other playwrights because of the beautiful music that leaves their lips, where we want to feel that they should never stop talking. That's the beauty of our art. And it's a collaboration of so many different arts into one big fat, a major art. And to me, once I got bit by the bug when I was 17, and I assume you got bit at a similar age, to me, when theater works, there is no art like it. And at the end of the day, it's an unalloyed good, and it makes the world a little better place when done correctly. And so that was the genesis and the impetus to write this play. Not that I need to hear myself talk, not that I want to get back on stage because I'm a lousy actor, but, or I was when I was in college, but there's a story here to tell, and it's because it's my story, I feel, well, you know, what the hell, let me tell it rather than cast another actor, because even though it's 2 years ago, Andrew, there's still a visceral reaction to many of the monologues where I am feeling exactly what I felt 2 years ago. And it creates a very emotional situation at a rehearsal, like it did last night. Obviously, we opened on Saturday, so we're doing final run-throughs now in Dressed Tech and the rest of it. And we ran the play yesterday, and I had to stop myself because I remembered vividly struggling to walk for the first time without the use of a cane or a walker. And I remember the titanic struggle that I had to go through 2 years ago when my PT insisted made me walk without help. And it was a titanic struggle 2 years ago. And all those feelings came right back to me last night. All in all, I'm doing is walking from stage left to stage right. But I went, holy crap, the feelings from 2 years ago, they're like, they're coming. I'm getting like emotional with this. Like I'm filled with emotion now. And it obviously affected the other six people on stage. And so that's what I hope to impart and depict in the presentation of the play.
It's incredible. Wow. So I kind of want to snowball off of that. I want to dig a little deeper because I'd love to know what has it been like developing the piece, especially since it's so personal.
Like I said, I've been a playwright for 41 years. A couple of plays have been titanic struggles to write. And when that happens, Andrew, the results are mediocre. And I would have no trouble citing examples where they were a struggle to leave the pen. But several plays I've written, and this is like false modesty aside, and this play flew out of my fingers. And I don't remember writing it. It just magically appeared on paper. Obviously not, but just as obvious, it kind of did, because all of a sudden I have this play. It has an interesting lead character that should be empathetic and a lot of funny stuff around it. And I went, oh, wow, there's a play here. And in fact, the play was longer and I cut it down to 45 scenes. And then I know at least the play is not going to suck. It's going to have some merit. There's going to be some redeeming value to it. I feel, or the sense that I get, is that one of the beauties of theater is like, it's like a newspaper. Every day when you start a newspaper, you begin with nothing. And then 24 hours later, holy crap, there's a newspaper in my hand that came from nothing. And they do that every day. The same thing with theater. There's a wonderful sign in the Dramatists Guild office on 528th Avenue that says the following. Only the writer was here when this page was blank. And that's a wonderful sentiment. And that's what this was. I'm staring at a blank piece of paper when I got out of the hospital. And I have finally lived what I lived through. And I went, you know what? There's a play here. And I just started recapturing and recounting scenes between this one and that one. My son, my ex-wife, several people in my family, obviously several people in the hospital. And I went, oh, wow, I can structure a play here. And Andrew, my hand to God, I think I wrote it in 3 days. And I'm not bragging because, like I said, sometimes it takes 8 years to write a play or years to write a play. And you know it's going to be mediocre, or the struggle is directly proportional to how effective it is with an audience. But when you write a play and you don't remember writing it, then you know that theater magic has like enveloped you. And that's what it did with this play.
That is incredible. That is absolutely incredible. And that time frame is even more mind-blowing, because that is definitely not typical of a work. So.
No, it's not. My students, like I have a few students, they've been struggling with a play, which is a more normal time frame, 6 months, 12 months, 15 months, 2 years. And that's expected for novice playwrights. And back in the day, when I was their age, I hate to say that, but like that's what it is, that would be the same for me as a novice playwright. But I'm only going to write plays when I have something personal to say. And when I have something personal to say, it will be fairly quick for me to say it. I'm very aware of play structure. I know what the component parts of a play are. It's a mathematical thing that I'm mindful of. And so when I say 3 or 4 days, it just flew out of my hands at like 200 miles an hour. And I think the results on Saturday and in the run will be compelling theater viewing. That's what I think.
Amazing. Well, jumping off of that, I would love to know, is there a message or a thought you hope that audiences will walk away with?
Yes, there are several. The first one is, don't take your health or your safety for granted. There was a time when, and I've always been like an overeater since I'm a young boy. And right before I got sick, I'm not going to say my actual number, but it was over 240 pounds, over it. which was very heavy, overweight, eating crap, eating food I know I'm not supposed to eat, and just continue to do it because you take your health and your safety for granted. And I think going into the hospital was God's way or the universe's way to remind me how to live my life correctly. And I hope to impart that feeling in at least some audience members that will say, oh shit, Robert was overweight. Now he looks much better because facing death and scaring him has altered his behavior. I will not let myself get to that point. I will make a 180 right now before I have to wind up in the hospital. So that's really the first message I wish to impart with that. The other messages are more like specific. One, the health care system or the hospital system I was in was interesting, Andrew, because I ran into a couple of doctors, and I depict this in the play, that was so sure of my diagnosis of what was wrong with me or what ailment I had. And it turned out on more than one occasion that they were wrong, that they were incorrect. And the notion that doctors are this omnipotent beings, that was not my experience. Clearly, the hospital saved my life. I'm not hating on them, and I'm not hating on most of the nurses and doctors that did attend to me in a wonderful professional manner. But I did have a few encounters with a couple of doctors who were filled with piss and vinegar, and they thought that their blank, you know, was smelled better than mine. And at the end of the day, Andrew, here's really at the end of the day. Do you play chess, Andrew?
I do.
Okay. There's a good saying that's like a motto for life. At the end of the day, the king and the pawn get put back in the same box. You know what I mean?
Like, I love that.
Right. You can carry that with you the rest of your life. I carry that with me. At the end of the day, the king and the pawn or the queen and the pawn, they get put back in the same box. So the doctors, they put their pants on one leg at a time, just like I do. We are all lambs to the slaughter. That's all we are. But I hope that maybe a doctor or like someone who thinks they're full of themselves sees this and says to themselves, oh, you know what? Maybe I should learn a little humility or be a little bit more compassionate and empathetic to other people's sufferings. That's what I hope to impart with the play also. And also a third thing would be a lot of what happened in the hospital was really, at least in my experience, drop dead funny. And like what I said to you at the top of this interview, rule number one in life, which comes from David Mamet, actually, never lose your sense of humor. And I can safely say that the 6 months hospital experience that I went through, I was able to maintain my sense of humor, even in the direst of situations where when I started losing feeling in my legs and I could not walk and the doctors could not figure out why I couldn't walk at the beginning, I was able to maintain my sense of humor. And that was very important to me. I remember watching as a 14-year-old boy, this is like 1974. I don't know how old you are, but I suspect you're younger than me. So in 1974, I was 14 years old. And there was a special on 60 Minutes about a book editor or a magazine editor. I can't remember his name. And the episode on 60 Minutes was it depicted this man. Oh, Norman Cousins. I just remembered his name. He was the editor or a book editor or something like somewhere in the literary world. And he was diagnosed with cancer. And rather than take chemotherapy and admit himself into the hospital, what he did was two things, the following. He changed his diet and he watched a nonstop revival of Marx Brothers movies. That's all he did. And according to him, he laughed his way back to health. That's according to the story. Now, the story may have been edited and it may have been tweaked to like put the best foot forward where you skip the chapters that don't really reflect well on them. I have no idea, but I do remember watching it on 60 Minutes. And I remembered it literally for 50 years to like keep your sense of humor no matter what is going on around you, because only good things will happen. Once you lose your sense of humor, you are no longer living. And those are the messages I wish to impart with my play.
I love those ideas. Those are absolutely brilliant. And I support those ideas 100%. Yeah.
Great.
So my final question for this first part is, who do you hope have access to 45 scenes of Bad Sickness?
Well, we always hope for a better day in the theater world. I've been in the theater 47 years. I know you've been in the theater since you were a kid. And a lot of people are like us. And we're always hoping that a producer comes by or the descendant of Joe Papp comes by and says, oh, Robert, you've got something here. Let me put some money behind it. That has always been our Achilles heel in our art. In order to do our art, we need to have some contact with money, because doing our art generally costs more money than the average bear. And we can't just do, we can't recite soliloquies from Macbeth on the 14th Street subway platform, because that doesn't cut it. We need to have a playing area. We need to have technical elements that enhance our theatrical experience. We need to pay other people. We don't do this for free. At the beginning, maybe we do it for free just to you know, earn our bones and to like build up our resume. After a while, doing it for free is childish and juvenile. So we want to get paid at least for the fruit of our labor. And so, but that is very hard, especially in 2024, because there are so many options for the public to go to rather than go to theater. It is easy to turn on the television, to turn on Netflix, to stream something, to just hang out and be like a self-cleaning oven, rather than go out in 11-degree weather or go out in 111-degree weather and wondering, will the seat be comfortable? Will there be air conditioning? Well, am I going to freeze my ass off? If I'm late for the show, will I miss it? Like, there's so many variables that run counter to going to the theater. And I'm hoping to reach people, like you had said before, coming out of the pandemic, kind of anyway, where I hope there's some sort of renaissance in our art, that people will say, you know what? There's nothing like a live event. That's the only thing that theater can pin its hat on. Everything else, it's secondary. But there is nothing like a live event. And that is what we offer to our audience, and have offered that for 2,500 years and 2,500 more years, God willing. And that's what I hope to impart to our audience.
Second part of our interview, we love giving our listeners a chance to get to know our guests a little bit better. Pick your brain, if you will. And I would love to start by asking you, what or who inspires you? What playwrights, composers, or shows have inspired you in the past, or are just some of your favorites?
The plays that inspired me, that's a good question. When I was 14, I saw the original production of Pippin with Ben Vereen and John Rubinstein. And I loved it. And I remember, because I come from poverty, but somehow I was able to scrape up $5 to go, and it was a student discount. For $5, you can stand behind the orchestra and watch the show. And I somehow got $5. This is 1973 or 74. And I watched Pippin and loved it. So I loved musical theater. I love music anyway, but musical theater, that was a special production for me. Then, fast forward 5 years from then, I went to see a play with my girlfriend at the time. The play was written by Atho Fugard. Are you familiar with him, a South African playwright? Came up a little bit. He's a wonderful writer. He passed a while ago, but he was a wonderful writer. Atho Fugard, and he wrote a play called A Lesson from Alos. And I saw it when I was 19. So it was in my second or third year in college. And the strangest experience, where I was watching the play and experience it in a visceral manner. And the play was very well written. But at the same time, Andrew, my hand to God, this is exactly what happened. It was an otherworldly, other body experience. While I was watching the play and engaged in the moment-to-moment reality of the characters, at the same time, I can see the script like superimposed over the proscenium stage. And I could just see the structure of the play while I was watching the three actors and actresses perform the role. And when the show came down, I remember saying to myself, and I said to my girlfriend at the time, I said, this is how I want to spend my life. I think this is magical and beautiful and wonderful. And so I studied it more. I founded a few theater companies. I've been involved in lots of productions. And I'm always drawn to my favorite quote about the theater, which inspires me to this day. I know you've heard of the Manhattan Theater Club, yes? The Manhattan Theater Club has always been an institution that always does great work. And for the longest time, she may still be there. The artistic director was a woman named Lynn Meadow. And I'm going to quote her, my favorite quote of the theater. Someone asked about her, about something, whatever, blah, blah, blah. And this is what she said. I love being in the theater because it makes me happy. And when I read that quote, I said, that is exactly how I feel. When I am in the theater is when I am happy. And so when you speak of benchmark watershed moments in the theater, those two come to mind. And there's been like this cloud that I've been riding for all these years. And it's not always a white cloud. It's a rain cloud. It's a black cloud. You know, I've written shit. I've gone to see shit. I've been rejected more times than I care to remember with my work. And it's like I said at the beginning, God never made a mountain with a smooth side. So it's always, there's always a hill to climb. But between those two productions and in 1984, 85, I dated a woman who worked for the Nederlanders. And she was able to get tickets to opening night for free. And I come from poverty. I could never afford a Broadway ticket. And she and I would go. I saw so many openings of Broadway shows in 1983, 84, 85. I would have no trouble listing them here, but that's not the point. The point is that the excitement of an opening night of a successful theatrical enterprise was and remains extremely thrilling and fulfilling to me. Even after all these years, and even at my jaded age of 64, Andrew, like 2 months ago, I took my girlfriend to go see Merrily We Roll Along. There's a revival that's going on. I think it closes in 2 weeks. And I remember when it came out in 81, and it's Sondheim, and I love Sondheim. And it closed on Broadway because it failed. And the whole theater world was looking forward to this revival because of a few reasons. One, they changed the book. And two, it's Sondheim. And three, Daniel Radcliffe plays one of the leads, the kid from Harry Potter. And I went to see it. Andrew, I loved every goddamn second of that production. And it reminded me why I fell in love with this art in the first place. It's a production like this that I just saw, Merrily, that sustains me and gives me breath and hope for a better day where hopefully a year from now, 5 years from now, 2 weeks from now, someone might see my play and go, you know what, Robert, here's $100,000. Let's put this on Broadway. Let's send this out to Louisville or Boston or Philadelphia, wherever. And it is those productions that really resonate with me and sustain me and give me hope and give me breath. Those are some of the productions that have inspired me.
I love that list. That is an incredible list. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Well, let me ask you, what is your favorite part about working in the theater?
I love the creative process. I love the idea of making something from nothing. I love being around theater artists because we are in the minority. We take the road less traveled. We are not 9-to-5ers. We don't want to necessarily buy a home. We don't want to necessarily raise a family. We want to make the world a little better place, and we want to act on the gifts that God or the universe gave us. I learned a long time ago, when I was probably about your age, where someone said to me, either you can have a life in the theater, or you can have what most people perceive to be a normal life. And since I had a terrible childhood, the prospects of quote unquote a normal life did not appeal to me. So, and I've always loved writing. But then when I got bit by the bug, I went, oh, I love theater writing. I love several aspects of theater production. The first one, obviously, is I love dramatic writing. Dramatic writing is very hard to do. So when I run into people who can do it, like I know I can on occasion, I teach some of students who they show potential. I would have no trouble citing plays that I regard as monumental contributions to literature. To me, that, along with haiku, is probably the two hardest things to write. So when I'm in a room with actors, directors, actresses, set designers, stage manager, you know, some tech guys, some PR people, it feels like it's a strong sense of community. I know we're in the minority, and I feed on that. I've always been for the underdog, and living a life in the theater, I cherish that. Being around people who view the same way, who view the world the same way that I do. There are too many people that just like are going for the brass ring, making the most money, going to bed with as most women or most men or whatever the hell with it, you know, who have notches on their belt with that, or want to raise 15 children. That never appealed to me. If you want to do that, knock yourself out. But I want to be in part of an art that makes the world a slightly better place. And the people I associate with, and especially now, the people who I'm doing the show now with at Open Saturday, the feeling that I have, and they're younger than me, the feeling that I have is that they view the world the same way. And I also enjoy, because I'm older than them, I'm probably old enough to be their parent, that they are able to learn from me, that I am able to part the wisdom I have garnished from being in the theater for 1,000 years, that they are receptive to that. And I like the passing of the baton. I love that idea. I'm constantly talking about theater in the 20th century or the Restoration period or Shakespeare or the Greeks or the Romans, because I want them to know where we come from. And then one day when I'm shuffled off this mortal coil, that they're going to continue this beautiful art when I pass the baton to them, and they will continue that, because this is an art that needs to be kept alive and vibrant and relevant to our times. And as long as there's turmoil in the world, and obviously there's so much turmoil in the world now, then theater will always be relevant. The two most important times in American history where theater was at its premium were the two most chaotic times in American history. And that's not a coincidence. The 1930s and the 1960s, when the country was in the midst of a depression or in the midst of an upheaval with women's rights, civil rights, an unpopular war. And then eventually after that was Watergate and the energy crisis. And that's when theater was most popular. That is not a coincidence. There is a reason for that. There is a reason that nobody studies Roman theater. There is a reason that nobody does plays that are written in the 1920s, because they're irrelevant. You talked about something that lost its luster with regarding to relevance. That would be a perfect example of it. There are some plays written in the 1920s or even 10 or 15 years ago that are completely irrelevant, that had a shelf life, that have disappeared, were topical, and are no longer part of the canon of theater. However, there's always a revival of Death of a Salesman, or there's always Shakespeare revivals, or you spoke about Color Purple, or I spoke about Merrily, because that's a story that always needs to be told. And Andrew, I want to be part of that storytelling.
I Love that answer. That is such an impassioned answer. Yes. And it leads to my favorite question to ask guests, which is, what is your favorite theater memory?
I have two favorite theater memories. And they both like, they're like bookends. The first one was in 2009. They used to be, I don't know if she's coming back, but they used to be the New York International Fringe Festival, of which my play was selected. And the play was called The Check Is in the Mail. And the performance times, because it was a festival during the summer, were at odd hours. And so the fourth or fifth show was at 11 o'clock at night, and it was at the Players Theater. And it was filled with 200 people, which was very nice. Most people I didn't know. And I was hanging around after the show, and a woman who I did not know came up to me outside the theater, and she said, "Excuse me, are you the playwright?" I said, "Yes, I am." She said, "I loved your show." I said, "Well, thank you very much." And then she said the following, "That all came out of your head?" And I said, "Yes, it did." And then she said, "I got about 80% of it." And I went, "Thank you very much, and have a safe ride home." The fact that she didn't get 100% and the fact that she only got 80 and was going to wonder about the 20% on the train ride home, that meant the world to me. That's one favorite memory. Then the second favorite memory just happened 2 years ago, before I got sick, right before I got sick. I wrote a play called Coal Train in Japan. And that is either my best work or my second best work. It's really well written. I'm not just saying that because I wrote it. I've written some shit. I know I have. I've written mediocre crap. But this one really sparkles. And the play has two Japanese characters in the play. And by the end of the run, we were playing to sold out houses. And on the final performance, Andrew, I looked around in the house. There were about 80, 85 people there. And not only did I not know anyone, but almost everyone was Japanese in the audience. Almost everyone. And I went, "Oh, wow, that is wonderful. I am reaching out to a culture of which I know very little of, and yet it is the theater that binds us." And here they are, they're coming to see this play. The title obviously is a good indicator. Plus I had two characters that were Japanese, played by Japanese actors. And here I am reaching over the Pacific Ocean through my writing, 12,000 miles away, and we're bound by the same thing. And those are my two favorite theater memories.
Wow. Wow. Those are amazing. I love those. Thank you so much for those. Well, as we wrap things up, I would love to know, do you have any other projects or productions coming on the pipeline we might be able to plug for you?
I am toying with the idea of a revival of my best play, which is called Coulda, Woulda, Shoulda. I'm hoping to mount a production in early 2025 off Broadway. And it's a play about gambling. And gambling wrecked my childhood and wrecked my parents' marriage and my household. And so it's very dear to me. It's a good play. It's been done 12, 15 times throughout the country. And I think we're going to give it one more shot to win the Pulitzer and the Tony. And that will be the next project that I have coming up.
Amazing. Well, my final question for you is, if our listeners would like more information about 45 Scenes of Bad Sickness about you, perhaps they'd like to reach out to you, how can they do so?
They could do so in two ways, I guess. My email address, if they have a question or comment, which is liebo12360@yahoo.com. Or they can call the box office, which is at 917-204-9589.
Wonderful. Well, Robert, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me and sharing this amazing piece of theater.
Absolutely.
I truly
thank
hope
you
I
for
get
having
to come out and see it. This sounds amazing. So thank you so much.
You're welcome. And thank you for having me. And Andrew, if you have an afternoon or a night to kill, I'm happy to leave you a ticket. I'll leave two on the aisle for you, and you could. And the show is short. It's 70 minutes without a break. And it's funny. It's quick. It gets its point across, and it's not long at all. So if you have a night to kill, come on down.
My guest today has been the amazing playwright Robert Liebowitz, whose new work, 45 Scenes of Bad Sickness, is being presented by None of the Above Theater Company. It's happening May 25th through June 2nd, Thursday through Sunday, at the Little Church, and you can get your tickets and more information by visiting ticketstripe.com. We also have some contact information for Robert, which we'll be posting on our episode description as well as on our social media posts. But right now, hurry over to ticketstripe.com, get your tickets for this fantastic, funny, poignant piece of theater. Again, it's 45 Scenes of Bad Sickness happening May 25th through June 2nd. So until next time, I'm Andrew Cortez reminding you to turn off your cell phones, unwrap your candies, and keep talking about the theater.
In a stage whisper.
Thank you.
If you like what you hear, please leave a 5-star review, like, and subscribe.
You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram at Stage Whisper Pod.
And feel free to reach out to us with your comments and personal stories at stagewhisperpod@gmail.com.
And be sure to check out our website for all things Stage Whisper and theater. You'll be able to find merchandise, tours, tickets, and more. Simply visit stagewhisperpod.com. Our theme song is Maniac by Jazzar. Other music on this episode provided by Jazzar and Billy Murray. You can also become a patron of our show by logging on to patreon.com/stagewhisperpod. There you will find all the information about our backstage pass as well as our tip jar. Thank you so much for your generosity. We could not do this show without you.